Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
We've got Korg.
He's my best friend!
Yes!
There's my ex-girlfriend, Jane.
Valkyrie.
This is the best day!
And giant goats.
Oh, look at those. They are wonderful.
Yes, they are. They also scream quite a lot.
Since taking over Marvel's Thor franchise in 2017, director Taika Waititi has stripped away much of the Shakespearean bombast and replaced it with a commitment to often inspired cartoon silliness. And to goats. I'm not complaining.
Mileage, as they say, may vary. This week, we've got a review of the new Thor, Love and Thunder, and in a commitment to our own cartoon silliness, we re-power rank the movie Chris's.
That and more.
Christoph Waltz.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome to Film Spotting. We have had many occasions since 2018 to revisit our movie Chris power rankings, Josh, but finally, this is the week.
This is something we've got to get right. I mean, it's not something you just toss off willy-nilly.
Uh-huh.
You want to give this time. You want to let it percolate. You want to reevaluate perhaps on a, you know, every 3, 4, maybe 5 years. I mean, we don't take this lightly.
All right, 2026, we will do this again. Later in the show, we will share our updated power rankings of the movie Chris's in alphabetical order. Evans, Hemsworth, Pine, Pratt.
But first, screaming goats and possibly a screaming Adam in our review of Thor, Love and Thunder.
Kids, get the popcorn out.
Let me tell you the story of the space Viking,
Thor Odinson. He was no ordinary man. He was a god.
After saving planet Earth for the 500th time, Thor set off on a new journey.
Well, he got in shape. He went from dad bod to god bod. And after all that,
Mjolnir,
he reclaimed his title as the one and only Thor. Oh, spoke too soon.
Jane?
Adam, I was so excited to see the review of Thor Love and Thunder that you logged on Letterboxd. For this fourth Thor movie proper and 29th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, in which Chris Hemsworth's God of Thunder reunites with Natalie Portman and Tessa Thompson to take on a new villain played by Christian Bale, all under the guidance of Thor Ragnarok director Taika Waititi, you handed out a paltry 1 out of 5 stars. This sent me down a bit of an Adam Kempinar Letterboxd rabbit hole.
Oh, no.
Do you know how many other films
there aren't many.
You've given 1 out of 5 stars since starting your Letterboxd account? And I think there's a 50% chance you do know this off the top of your head.
Honestly, there's been a 1.5 or 2, maybe a few more. But yeah, maybe 1 or 2 1-star reviews. That's it.
You're close. Indeed. Only one-star review has been given by you to Love and Thunder. You mentioned the 1.5-star rating. Yes, you've handed out more of those. 16, actually.
Wow.
Including a handful I like. Probably not surprising to either of us, but really, Adam, A life less ordinary couldn't have hurt you that much. Come on.
Barely it did.
My point is that generally you are not a hater. And so something about Thor, Love and Thunder really got under your skin. Now, I know we like to stay positive on the show. We try to give time to movies we feel we have a good chance of appreciating. But the MCU can take it. So let it have it. More specifically, please elaborate on the two sentences you did give the movie along with that single star. You wrote, "Everyone who went crazy for Ragnarok, you're on notice." As a Ragnarok appreciator, I actually liked it a bit more on a recent revisit. How much trouble am I in?
Yeah, you're definitely one of the people I was thinking about when I wrote that. I came out of retirement on Letterboxd for all of two sentences. But hey, you got an intro out of it, so it was worth it. I just remember a fair number of reviews at the time Ragnarok was released, fawning all over Taika Waititi. What boldness! Here is a director daring enough to subvert all of the self-importance of the MCU and Thor himself with full-blown silliness, injecting an actual personality and unique sensibility into these mass-produced widgets, making superhero movies fun. What madness this is. And I also remember how I reluctantly gave it my barely passing muster 3 out of 5-star rating on Letterboxd for those very reasons, despite how uneven I thought the storytelling was. So my sarcastic little quip there was just to call out everyone like you who encouraged Taika and Marvel to, I don't even know if they quadruple down, they quintuple downed on both the silliness and the unevenness resulting in Love and Thunder. Yes, one of the least enjoyable times I've had at the theater in recent memory. And no, this isn't fun. I don't want to be the hater. Who wants to be the scold? I hate being negative about movies, especially movies where filmmakers are taking big swings. It's also, for me anyway, frankly, difficult to articulate why a movie doesn't work when it doesn't work for me as consistently and completely as this one does. So I'm going to disappoint you at least at first, but don't worry, I'll get there. I want to go back. I had Sam Van Halgren's voice in my head, our producer, former co-host, as I walked out of the theater so angry.
What can I salvage?
I want to go back. Yeah, to the early days of the show and invoke the Sam Van Halgren rule to start with something positive. And really, here's where I should just turn it over to you to give some positives. But I'm going to say this. Christian Bale. Gore the God Butcher. A villain who is really scary. And I don't mean scary like he's so strong and merciless and intimidating that he's thrilling to watch or he's a formidable antagonist, though I'd say that's all mostly true. No, I mean he's actually scary. The makeup and effects, that chalky pale skin and the black ooze that he summons but also seems to be consuming him, those yellow eyes. Longtime listeners know about me and yellow eyes in horror movies. That voice, he is terrifying. Now, he belongs in a different movie probably, but he's terrifying. When all the little Asgardian kids are talking in their cage, and he emerges from the dark, having been listening to them, and he starts orating to the kids, all I could think about, Josh, was how if I was one of them, I don't care what world I'm from, or who my parents are, or how many supernatural things I've witnessed, I would either just cower in the back, refusing to look at him, or I'd start screaming and never stop. Like Cate Blanchett in Ragnarok, it just seems like it's always a good idea to cast one of these weighty British thespians in these roles because they inherently seem to understand how to embrace the absurdity of it all while fully committing. And that is my lone significant positive about Thor, Love and Thunder. What do you got?
Yeah, it's interesting because he stands out apart from what this movie really wants to be doing. So it makes sense that you would point to that as something you liked. I think it's similar to Blanchett in Ragnarok in that her whole storyline could have almost been its own separate movie. And I agree with you. Gore could have been his own separate movie. I think he's a very compelling character. Just this idea that he's this God butcher. There are so many interesting theological implications to that the movie somewhat explores, but really wants to get away from as quickly as possible so it can attempt to quintuple down on that silliness. For me, I think this movie still felt less silly and less fun than Ragnarok, even though it might have tried, maybe that's the answer, it's trying harder to be silly, yeah, right, than Ragnarok mm-hmm. was. So there's an effortlessness that was fresh in Ragnarok that isn't here. I still do like this. I'm going to defend it, but I don't think when you get to your criticisms, there's anything I'm really going to be able to disagree with or out-logic you about, because I see all of the potential weaknesses and why this would rub someone the wrong way. I've got it in my MCU rankings, very much mid-tier, you know, just at that edge of the movies that I give a positive review to, but I don't think are anywhere near among the franchise's best. I do think, for me, what this comes down to is those moments in Love and Thunder, and there are just enough of them where you hit these sublime stretches and it really does not care about being a coherent movie at all. And here's where the quintupling down pays off. In Ragnarok, you did still have that tension a little bit between what Thor was before. And again, I've said this on the show, but I want to reiterate, the first Thor is extremely funny. And this character was humorous from the very beginning. It's not like YTT came in and completely re-envisioned him. Hemsworth, it's one of the reasons he's one of my more preferred movie Chris's, is a supreme comedic talent. And I think that was played up in the first Thor movie, got lost a little bit in the second, and then they really leaned into it with Ragnarok and still take advantage of that here. And there are some stretches, for example, when it's Hemsworth on screen, and I feel like everything I'm going to say, I'm just going to see your face and it's just going to be a frown, another frown. All these things that I did find amusing. Uh-huh. But anytime Hemsworth was having a talk with Stormbreaker, his axe, his new weapon, that is jealous of Mjolnir. Mjolnir? Yeah. Mjolnir? Yeah. Am I getting that right?
Mjolnir!
His former weapon, you know, the hammer. And it's this comedic sort of exchange. Honestly, that was more of an emotional and humorous interaction than a lot of what we get with Natalie Portman's Jane. I think Jane here is an interesting character. Mm-hmm. Again, deserves her own movie. But for me, it was those moments where Thor's just talking to his axe very earnestly. Meanwhile, in the back of this Viking ship that's sailing through space being pulled by these screaming goats. And yes, Adam, I never tired of the screaming goats. Mm. That's one of those jokes. They pushed it through until it became unfunny and then funny and then unfunny and then funny. And then you were just, you know, I was left at its mercy. This is all happening while the screaming goats are pulling them. And you've got Tessa Thompson talking to Korg, the Rocky Korg, voiced by YTT, who at this point is reduced to just a face because he's lost his whole body in battle. And they're having this conversation at a bar in the back of the Viking ship. That's the stuff, you know, for me, that's going to push this over the edge to a movie I was glad I saw. I'm glad it exists in the MCU. I'm glad there's something this out there, this willing to be ridiculous, even if as a whole experience, it's even shakier than Ragnarok, which I agree isn't the most solid, cohesive narrative in the MCU.
Well, we will find some common ground here because I think I counted, if I remember correctly, the number of times I did chuckle during Thor: Love and Thunder. It was on one hand, it was three times, and two of them were intimate conversations with Stormbreaker.
Oh, good.
So we agree on that. That worked. And I think the goats are a really good microcosm for this entire movie and one's potential experience with it. I'll say this. I can appreciate the irreverent, indulgent instinct it displays and still really want it to stop. And so as much as I can give YTT points, especially during that extended sequence you're talking about, for embracing a certain dementedness and restraint and logic be damned, at the end of the day, you still have to deliver. And for me, this movie is so lifeless. I don't know how many times I had to watch a cut to a close-up of a really talented actor looking so bored and uninvested, where I was fully aware, it seemed anyway, that they were reacting or not to a tennis ball on a pole or something. It was very detached, and it's also empty and kind of artificial feeling, which then makes it even more annoying when it tries to shoehorn in genuinely grave and sentimental moments, as this movie does sprinkle in throughout. And you can keep, I don't even know if I want to call it faux expressionistic black and white look of the Shadow Realm. I'd love to hear if you disagree, Josh. There wasn't one memorable or compelling visual choice made in terms of the construction of a scene or the compositions. The only choice here is chaos, which just isn't enough for me. And for a movie seemingly made, you said it was trying very hard. Yes, for a movie seemingly made with the sole purpose of inserting as many goofy gags per minute as possible, while employing a healthy dose of vivid colors and rousing GNR hits, Love and Thunder is shockingly lethargic. Most of the gags landed with the thud of Thor's hammer, whichever one you want to invoke here. And I don't think you can divorce the poor pacing from the complete lack of stakes, structure, or anything resembling narrative coherency, unfortunately.
I thought for sure the Guns N' Roses might carry you over, might
Me
be
too.
Enough, Adam. So yeah, that's really saying something. As far as the visual scheme goes, I was actually surprised that this wasn't more vibrant from all of the marketing materials I saw. And I think I actually did see the trailer for this before watching the film itself. It wasn't as, and I'm not just talking about when Gore is on screen. His whole thing is that, yes, he's operating this shadow realm and he's devoid of color. Even the ones with Thor are not quite as slap happy, colorful as I expected. You get some of that. I do think that sequence on the shadow realm is the one that is distinctive, but they don't push it far enough. That's where I thought there was going to be more made of the color, where this moon or whatever it is, that it's just a complete gray color scale. And then you have Thor and his team coming in. That was almost a missed opportunity, because I agree with you. Otherwise, this is very CGI blah, among the most blah of any Marvel installment that we've seen. Certainly the visuals are not a strength. I want to go back to what you're saying about the disinterested performances as you perceive them. Would you put Portman in that category? Because I think her appearance here as Jane and transformation into the mighty Thor, this isn't spoiling anything. Mm-hmm. It happens fairly early on. She takes over the hammer. It becomes her weapon. We also learn that she is suffering from terminal cancer. And these were all intriguing elements that, yes, in the screenplay, thematically connect with what Gore is about, with what Thor is going through. But I don't think they ever quite make sense on the screen. But is Portman one of those performances you're thinking about?
As I was saying that, I'm envisioning her expressionless face. And it isn't to say that I think throughout the movie that she's not going for it or giving overall a solid performance. I think it's more in those visual choices and the fact that in a lot of these instances, when they're cutting to people for reaction amidst all that CGI insanity, you just can't find anything there of substance to latch onto, despite the movie's intent at some points and despite performers like Portman, I think, really giving it their all.
Yeah, I think it's tough for her. I do feel like she's invested the point to the point where when Jane is meant to be comedic, she has a scene particular I'm thinking of with Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie. It works, and there's a chemistry between them. And you can see a movie that might have been just those two and had been able to establish its own tone.
Yeah.
Jane's even a little goofy there. But her main defining trait in this film is that she is dying. And so then we suddenly jerk towards other sequences where that is supposed to give us the emotional heft. And the movie doesn't give her enough scenes to encompass both of those directions. I think it's possible to do that. But again, if she had her own movie. So I agree with you. Portman, you know, does a disservice to Portman in that character. Here's a performance I think we're going to split on, but I'm putting this in the pro category. Never would have guessed it. When I saw him in the trailer, I thought, oh, this is not
going
to work.
I know where you're
like,
going.
It's just, they're just casting for the trailer. That was my experience. It's like they're casting because it'll play in 30 seconds. And if it's any more in that than in the movie, it's not going to work. But for me, to see Russell Crowe as Zeus in a fairly extensive sequence, I think he also completely goes for it. I think
fairly extensive.
He's on. It's like a 10-15 minute scene, right?
I think it's 45 or 50 minutes long, actually.
Okay.
I think
all
you should
right.
go back and watch it again.
I think he gives it his all. I think the material is there, and I thoroughly enjoyed whatever it was he was doing. Whether he was auditioning for House of Gucci or My Big Fat Greek Wedding, those were the two accents I pulled. Whatever he was doing completely yeah. worked for me.
Well, Crow falls into that same category of the goats I mentioned earlier, right? Where you can have extended sequences like that that can be generally amusing and you can really appreciate the indulgence of it. But that isn't to say it doesn't also stop the movie completely dead in its tracks. And that's the balance I don't think that Waititi can find here. He seems so bored with the material that he is going to overindulge in sequences like that. And I don't know if over 17 years of doing the show, I've been a good enough critic to start to formulate Kempinar rules. I'm definitely not a good enough critic, but one that this movie just really solidified for me. I've always been aware of it. I've probably brought it up in the past once or twice, but I was so clearly right away not on the Bifrost path with this movie. And here's how I knew it. If your movie includes any kind of get the audience up to speed montage with narration, oh my, does it have to be really funny or really profound or really boldly inventive in some way? Because otherwise I will immediately start tuning you out. And there's just not enough of a payoff to the sort of fairy tale conceit of this movie with Waititi's Korg telling us.
Yeah, it happens a couple of times.
To justify the montages we get here, you might as well have been tucking me into bed.
You didn't like the mini rom-com with Portman and Hemsworth? I mean, I thought that one was a little amusing, but I agree, it does become a crutch. And when you yeah. can sense, when you can sense it's a crutch and they're not able to also have fun with it, that's where it can become a problem. For that rom-com section, I thought that worked. I thought that was a little bit
There were a couple
fun.
Moments there.
Yeah. And let me give you a couple more that worked for me. And again, overindulgence, that's the phrase to use. I think that's what I'm into this movie for, is those 10 minutes or 40 in your time of overindulgence. That's where, even if not every gag works, again, I'm getting something that feels at least fresh to me. I think you have comic actors who can pull it off for the most part. A couple of throwaways, though. This is actually in the Zeus sequence. How about Thor's R.I.P. Loki tattoo? I mean, come on. That's fun, right?
Yeah.
And then, and otherwise,
it got a guffaw for me.
Okay, good.
Great as a chuckle.
Good.
Sorry.
I like it. Otherwise, in a fairly pointless opening battle sequence with the Guardians of the Galaxy, except it's, you know, helpful perhaps as we consider our re-ranking of the Chrises.
Oh, it was.
Because Chris Pratt appears there.
Does he?
He does. You may have missed him.
Okay.
How about Thor's move? The splits midair between two aircraft to stop them and yeah. essentially win the battle. I wanted even more of that as the movie proceeded. It almost hit a high of, we're just going to completely make Thor a clown at this yeah. point. You know, he doesn't quite know it yet that he's this level of clown, but we're going to do it in this film. And I think they back away from that when they have to get serious, when it has to tie in with other elements of the MCU. Though I would also say, for the most part, this installment is mercifully short on a lot of that stuff compared to others we get. It's there. But once the Guardians, you know, get out of the way, we don't get a ton of it. I don't know. That move worked for me as well. And I get just enough of those little bits of overindulgence that made me glad I saw this.
Yeah, no, that is a fun moment, and it is a perfect example of those types of indulgences we've been talking about, because he does those splits, and Waititi doesn't hold it for 3 seconds, or 5 seconds, or 7 or 8, or maybe not even 10. It gets a solid 12 or 15, I think.
Yeah, well, those ships, he's got moment. It's a test of strength.
Yeah.
A test of the loins, Adam.
Uh-huh.
And he wins.
Let's not talk about Hemsworth and loins in your wife's review of Thor: Love and Thunder, Josh.
She was happy to see him back in shape.
There is, I bet, a very memorable scene that I'm sure many enjoyed in the film. I'm just going to get mean here. I apologize.
Oh,
I saved it for the end of the review. But you know who the big winner of Thor Love and Thunder is? It's Jon Favreau. Because no longer can people like me point to Iron Man 2 as the nadir of the MCU. Coincidentally here, or maybe ironically even, the one MCU movie I haven't seen is Thor 2. And maybe that belongs at the bottom. But right now, Jon Favreau, you're out of the ditch, buddy. You no longer have made the worst MCU movie because Taika Waititi did.
You've got this ranked last.
Yeah, man.
Dead.
I do.
Last.
I do. Now,
worse than the recent Spider-Man movie we mercifully, ever reviewed. Which one was that? Far From Home?
I'll have to
look. No, not Far From Home.
It has home in it, of course, but I don't remember what it's called.
No Way Home.
No Way Home. I either gave that 1.5 or maybe a very generous 2 stars. So you're right. I had less fun with this. I think I did somehow. Now, to get back real quick here at the end to a topic we will hit on later, of course, our movie Chris's. And I'm a fan of Hemsworth overall, like you are. I do think he has overall really sound comedic instincts, which he has shown over a few different movies. But I saw on Rotten Tomatoes, where this does have a pretty decent 67% rating, our friend and former colleague Allison Wilmore had a great quote. Josh, gore does seem to be onto something, Allison wrote in her review for Vulture. The gods floating obnoxiously above the fray of mortal concerns kind of suck. Unfortunately, this movie is about one of them. Now, I love the clever jab, but I do think she's maybe onto something about Thor that I'm just now, after 4 films, starting to realize might be a problem. He is a god who doesn't exhibit any of the humanity inherently of characters like a Tony Stark or a Steve Rogers or so many others. And thus, he is never really scared or sad, which is ironic for a movie that is constantly telling us how sad Thor is. There's a lot of telling in this movie. And I, again, appreciate that Waititi wants to puncture the self-seriousness of it all, and of Thor in particular, when we're talking about a movie that is fundamentally about space Vikings. Like, if we can't have a sense of humor about that and see the ridiculousness, then we're not doing something right. And yet, I just wonder if Allison is tapping into something, or at least she was, for me, tapping into something that felt fundamentally off about this film, at least between me and Thor. I didn't have the connection with him, just like maybe Jane didn't have the connection we were hoping for, Josh.
I think this is why he's actually become one of my favorite characters, if not the best films, is because Thor was not a comic I read as a kid. I wasn't a huge comics nerd, but I read enough of them. Thor was one just never interested me. It seemed silly then. Same, I would say, with Iron Man and Tony Stark. It was just, you know, this guy who builds robots. No, that's, I'm not interested. And the MCU, the films, have managed to make both of those incredibly intriguing characters, to me at least. And humor has been a big part of that. So I would disagree. I don't think the problem is Thor or Hemsworth. The first Thor, actually, he's quite vulnerable. That's, you know, the thread of the entire film, actually. Now, has that shifted? Yes, as the series have gone on. Is this movie less interested in that? Yes. And also, I think back to kind of where we started, it's a matter of trying to be too many movies at once. When you're going to have him doing these yogi splits in the air, it's also difficult to then shift suddenly to conversations with Jane about her cancer. And so it's not that is missing from his character as these movies have envisioned him, but the balance is off. It's out of whack here in a way that this may not be Waititi's strength, at least in these movies. I think he balances it better in some of his other films, non-MCU films. But when it comes to this, he might be pushing the pedal a little bit too far in the overindulgence, and then some of these other elements suffer.
Thor, Love and Thunder is currently playing in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our thoughts, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
When we come back, I've got quick reviews of 2 new movies that, are definitely better than Love and Thunder. That would be The Deer King and Neptune Frost. Plus, it's another look at one of our most intellectual exercises ever, ranking movie Chris's. Stay with us.
Once upon a time, Tango Yakala. Once upon a time, Tango Yakala. Chira-chan is a money song. Chira-chan is a money song. Tulishi juya milima. My mother and father were binary stars. Nicolo Yangomba, c'est là qu'on s'est découvert. Nafsietu.
One justice agony, one little black girl agony. Is an opposing.
That's from the trailer for Neptune Frost, directed by Anicia Uzeman and Saul Williams. The Afrofuturist film set in Burundi debuted last summer at the 2021 Cannes Film Festival. It played in limited release earlier this summer, and it will be at Facets here in Chicago this weekend. Josh, you just caught up with it, which is great because then you can explain this to me. The plot description has, quote, cosmic forces bringing together an intersex runaway and an escaped miner, unquote, and their connection, quote, sparking glitches within the greater divine circuitry, unquote. I followed no part of that. Please elucidate.
Yeah, what's confusing to you? What more do you want to know? Let me note, about a third of the way through Neptune Frost, a character basically says in voiceover, maybe you're asking yourself, WTF is this?
It's one of those.
And I have to say, when I heard that, I was so relieved, because what it told me was that the bewildering nature of this movie was part of the plan. What you just read, you don't even need to know exactly what all that means, but I think it gives you some sense of the vibe. And I will add to that that this is pretty much a musical. You mentioned Saul Williams, and it is chock full of original songs. He's had a long career, among many other things, as a musician. So this is something that could be described as a musical. It is overall an experience, and you're awash in the Dayglow makeup and costume design that's part of this, that incorporates elements like computer chips that are used as jewelry, body art, or woven into the costuming. You have some arresting African landscapes and those songs, which are incredibly interesting. They're angry at sometimes, and they're celestial at other times. It feels like a visual album more than a traditional movie, or even a, you know, a movie musical, but I don't want to make that sound like it's light or there's not any substance here, because I think there's a vision of revolution that's really being projected in the music and in these characters. There's a hopefulness to it that an increasingly wired world might allow for a voice to emerge that hasn't been previously heard. This is an extremely poetic effort. I think that's why it does deserve consideration, or a nod at least, as a golden brick. So I want to go ahead and include it as one of those this year for our annual award for overlooked films from up-and-coming or new filmmakers. And yeah, it's a lot to take in. I think the less, if you're going to go see this, there are also streaming options, or if you're in Chicago at Facets, I think worry less about figuring it all out, because I looked back at my notes and it was full of question marks. Like, so is he, or does that mean she is? And as the movie went on, I stopped asking those. I got a few answers from the film itself, but I did stop asking those and just allowed myself to be immersed by what it was offering. I think that's the best way to enjoy it. And then perhaps, you know, if you want to dig into the political implications or the messaging or the other things that are going on here, especially in some of the lyrics that will need translation, you can do that later or on a second viewing. But it's definitely worth an initial viewing just for that immersive aesthetic experience.
If you can't get to Neptune Frost at Facets here in Chicago, it is available to rent on Amazon Prime, Kino Now, and Vudu. If you do see it, we'd love to hear your thoughts. Feedback at filmspotting.net. Busy critic that you are, Josh, you also caught up with a new animated film that's getting a limited theatrical release, The Deer King, from directors Masashi Ando and Masayuki Miyagi. Both are veterans of Studio Ghibli, working there on films by Hayao Miyazaki. Does the film have any of that Miyazaki magic?
Yeah, I think Princess Mononoke is probably the closest touch point, and they both did work on that. They also worked on Spirited Away. Also, among their credits, you'll see things like Your Name and Weathering With You, both of which I liked quite a bit. But it's Mononoke that this mirrors, because it is a fantasy narrative focuses on another miner, actually, an enslaved miner who escapes his captors along with a small orphan girl, and then they travel across this land that is under the rule of a colonial power. There's also a disease that's across the land, but it only threatens the invaders, not the people who have always lived there. There's actually, you know, politically or at least geopolitically, there are a lot of parallels with Neptune Frost as I'm describing this, but completely different experience here with the Deer King. This also has a rich supporting cast of characters that just makes it a more expansive vision, but it is the animation that is the standout. You just want to stare at every frame, one of those movies, one of those anime experiences. And I like how the directors and their team also make it, in terms of visuals, they make it personal. You can see a recurring POV shot that fades out as the eyelids close, but then it also has this vast world building to it. There is an unseen emperor, and you know he's around because these giant balloons that are painted to look like eyeballs, they just ominously loom against the horizon. So there's a nice balance between the personal and, again, this massive world building that the movie does. I'll be interested to see how it's received, because I could see some folks saying it's too close to something like Princess Mononoke. But for me, as much as I love that film, to see something that's in the vein, especially having just reviewed, what did I say, our 29th MCU movie, you know, I don't feel like this is something that has been exhausted yet, a movie like this. And there's enough idiosyncratic touches from these filmmakers to make it feel unique.
You know, one more makes a trend. Coming soon to Film Spotting, top five movie miners.
Let's do it.
M-I-N-E-R-S.
Yes, I'll keep my eye out.
The Deer King is currently playing in limited release. This week on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, I love this pairing. It's part one of their human slash nature pairing. Genevieve over there at The Next Picture Show is always very intentional. They've got the new doc Fire of Love out in limited release, and Werner Herzog's Grizzly Man from 2005. I'm not saying they took my idea at all, but I am saying I approve of this pairing, since you may recall when I singled out Fire of Love as my favorite film of the year so far a month ago, I brought up Werner Herzog's wonderful documentary, Grizzly Man.
Yeah, so this one works in your mind. I have yet to see Fire of Love. It sounds like the perfect pairing to me.
The Next Picture Show is hosted by Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts. And for our local Chicagoland listeners, I think Fire of Love is playing in 8 to 10 theaters across Chicagoland, and we have 8 pairs of tickets to give away to that really wonderful film. No, Josh, you are not eligible. I'm sorry. All you have to do, email us, feedback@filmspotting.net, put Fire of Love in the subject line, and you'll be randomly entered to win one of those pairs of passes.
Adam, you know Nope from Jordan Peele, right around the corner. We're going to be reviewing it the next time we get together. And that was also the reason, really the motivation behind the next gathering of the TC Movie Club, something I'm doing over at the day job. We're going to get together in August to consider the prophetic voice of Jordan Peele. And we're doing that in August so that we can weave in Get Out, Us, and Nope, which opens July 22. So just wanted to mention that to listeners in case they're interested. This is where we put a theological lens on a couple of our favorite movies, and we're focusing on Peele's work. We're going to get together online 2 p.m. Central, Saturday, August 6. And I also made a video essay specifically about Us that is on the Think Christian YouTube channel. If you want to check that out in advance, hope to prime the pump for the conversation with that video essay. If this sounds good to join us on August 6, go ahead and sign up at thinkchristian.net/movieclub. And then we'll email you the details, the Zoom invite, the meeting link, everything you'll need to get together and talk about the prophetic voice of Jordan Peele.
See, my mission is clear. Would you look at that girl? She is so adorably clueless. We've got to adopt her.
Cher, she is toe up. Our stock would plummet.
Dee, don't you want to use your popularity for a good cause?
No.
Alicia Silverstone as Cher in Amy Heckerling's Clueless, not only the definitive 90s time capsule movie, but also a remarkably faithful adaptation of Jane Austen's 1815 novel, Emma, Who Can Forget, when they get on the expressway in that Jane Austen novel. Josh, it is time for poll results. We asked our listeners a couple of weeks ago, what's your favorite Jane Austen film adaptation? That question inspired by a new Austen adaptation coming to Netflix this weekend. It stars Dakota Johnson. The reviews so far have not been very generous. Only 32% over on Rotten Tomatoes, a 40 on Metacritic. More than one critic accuses it of adapting Austen by way of Phoebe Waller-Bridge's Fleabag, and that sounds delightful to me, so I'm in. But let's forego the persuasion talk and see if another film adaptation topped our poll. The options, Josh, were Clueless, Sense and Sensibility from 1995, Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice from 2005, Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship, that's 2016, 2020's Emma starring Anya Taylor-Joy, or you could go other as long as you didn't cheat and try to write in a BBC TV adaptation. Josh, how did it come out?
Other is in last place with 6%. Then came, I think, the one I voted for, Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship, received 7% of the vote. 2020's Emma got 8%. And then we had a jump to the top three here. With 21% of the vote, it's 1995's Sense and Sensibility. 24% of the vote went to Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice, but Clueless took the poll with 34%.
I have to say, having just returned, as we did, from our annual jaunt to Spring Green, Wisconsin, where we took in some theater outdoors at American Players Theater. After seeing Sense and Sensibility this past Saturday night, I am really regretting that I haven't been more dutiful in my Jane Austen adaptation watching. And I've always been a little bit embarrassed that I've never seen inexplicably that Ang Lee Sense and Sensibility with Emma Thompson and Kate Winslet. I really feel shame now and can't wait to see it soon, Josh.
Well, you're just doing it right. Hopefully you read the book first, then
nope.
You saw the play.
Nope.
Then you're going to wait. Oh, haven't even
not going to happen.
Read the book.
Nope.
Okay.
All right. Here's Rick Taylor in Kelowna, British Columbia. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single poll in possession of a cult classic must be in want of fairness. Oh, well done, Rick. Surely you have put the cat amongst the pigeons by letting Clueless into this poll. While the other films qualify, they are like featherweights against the sublime vapidity of Heckerling's Makeover.
Wow. We also heard from Scott G. Joe Wright's adaptation of Pride and Prejudice is one of the few modest-scale dramas that I would jump at the chance to see in IMAX. The cinematography is just that gorgeous. I realize that lighting and lenses don't really impact the adaptation part of an Austen adaptation, but since this genre isn't usually my thing, Kira and company get my vote by virtue of the visuals.
Yeah, listeners know I didn't discover that Joe Wright had that visual genius in him until I saw his next film, Atonement, in 2007, so I do need to revisit Pride and Prejudice. Jen Small says, while Sense and Sensibility is probably my favorite on the list, I want to shout out Bride and Prejudice, the over-the-top Bollywood-style musical adaptation from 05. Gurinder Chadha, director of Bend It Like Beckham, makes this retelling a vibrant delight. Highly recommend it.
Okay. I remember not being quite as convinced at the time, but maybe I need to give that one a revisit, Jen. Here's Sean Means. Director Roger Michell's 1995 adaptation of Persuasion may have been made for the BBC, but it played theatrically in the States, so I am counting it.
Sean got us on a technical.
Oh, it is one of the most mature and thoughtful renditions of an Austen book, with a wonderfully nuanced lead performance by Amanda Root. Also important, it was one of the first leading man performances by Kieran Hines as the reserved but surprisingly emotional Captain Wentworth, who could make audiences swoon just by glancing down at a letter. Coming out the same season as Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility, Persuasion may have gotten lost, but it's a gem worth rediscovering. So I just have a couple of chapters left in Persuasion, Adam. Now that's all I'm going to picture. Kieran Hines as Captain Wentworth.
Okay, does that work for you?
I think it does. I can see it.
Okay. Here's Lisa R. Nelson closing us out. I've been a devoted Janeite ever since being introduced to her quiet Mansfield Park as a college freshman, and I find this question all the more difficult as TV miniseries have played such an integral role in Austen adaptations, with both Joe Wright's Pride and Prejudice and Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility owing much to their earlier TV versions. And while I agree with Sean Means that the excellent 1995 Persuasion is a true film, since it was released in theaters in the U.S., I'm not 100% sure that film should take the prize. Thank you to Jen for shouting out the fine Bollywood adaptation, Pride and Prejudice. I would also like to give some love to the utterly charming Fire Island, which is a surprisingly faithful Pride and Prejudice adaptation. We missed that one. So, who is the winner for me? It's down to both Love and Friendship and Clueless, which are both wonderfully original, but I got to go with my heart on this. So Clueless wins the day, and I think Jane would approve, hopefully Jane would approve of that poll question and the results, Josh.
While our new poll has us looking ahead to Jordan Peele's Nope, that does come to theaters next weekend. Peele, of course, made his feature directing debut 5 years ago with 2017's Get Out, also making directing debuts that year. Greta Gerwig with Lady Bird and Coconato with Columbus. And then a year later, Ari Aster made his debut with Hereditary. All four have since made follow-ups, Peele with Us, Gerwig with Little Women. Aster made Midsommar, and this year we got Coconata's After Yang. Why do we bring all of this up? Well, our next poll question is this. Which of those four directors is your favorite? Peele.
Favorite.
Gerwig. Coconata. Aster. Yeah, it sounds like you're already trying to think this out, Adam. So you're focusing on the favorite wording.
I am.
In the case of a filmmaker, is that distinct from best? We talk about that when it comes to films. Favorite film or best film? How about when it comes to filmmakers?
Well, I think I like to use that distinction when it serves my purposes.
Okay.
And in this case, there is an instinctual answer, and going with favorite probably helps it just a little bit, because we've got four really formidable filmmakers here. Now, there's only one that I can dismiss, and I know I'm probably in the minority, even though I think this filmmaker could finish last in this poll. I would bet it finishes last or a close to last, and that's Ari Aster. Have not been a big fan of either Hereditary or Midsommar. So it comes down to the other three, and I'm just a huge fan of all three of them. This is infuriating, Sam. This is a deeply flawed poll just because it flummoxes me so. And of those three, Peele is definitely the filmmaker whose films, and I'm not saying anything new or shocking here, his films have become events. And you feel like if you don't see them, you are missing out on something culturally. And that alone is probably enough to urge Jordan Peele on to victory. But my favorite, and you know I love Coconata, who I've had two conversations with here on the show, and those were as satisfying as any interviews I've ever done. Brilliant filmmaker. But I'm going with Greta Gerwig. After Lady Bird being my number one film of that year, and then when Little Women came out, my number two film of its year, it's Greta.
Yeah, this is where, you know, those dumb rankings at the end of the year and even star ratings maybe are a little helpful, because it's very difficult to choose among this group. For me, a little more difficult than you to put Aster aside from the other three, but I would agree with that. For me, that's what I'm going to do. And then looking at, oh boy, I mean, is it just the matter of you hear there's going to be a new film for the first time of this person coming out in 6 months?
Right.
Which one gets you to kind of like your eyes to pop open first? And I think it is for me, Peele. I mean, let me just say they would pop open the widest, because they would for the other two as well. Gerwig's films, I think, I'm not sure if both appeared on a top 10. Pretty sure Lady Bird did. Coconata's films, I mean, right now, we've talked about it when we did our midpoint. After Yang has a really decent shot of being my favorite film of the year. Jordan Peele's Us was my favorite film of the year that it came out. And of course, I absolutely love Get Out. So even if you're looking for me, if I do the IPOP test and also the ranking test, I think it is Jordan Peele.
You can vote in that poll. Can't wait to see how the results come out and how flummoxed our listeners are. You can leave a comment in that poll as well at filmspotting.net.
Excuse me. Sir? We're officers of the law.
You gonna run me in? I don't feel like talking. I'm distraught.
Hey, Benny, you want to ask this guy some questions?
All right, what is this? What's this arrangement?
Mr. Drysdale.
CSI KFC?
That's one of the top Chris's in the business. Chris Evans in a scene from Rian Johnson's Knives Out. Back in 2018, pre-Knives Out, we were looking for a top five to pair with our review of Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom.
We didn't review that.
I kind of want to pretend that we never did, but I think we did.
Did we really?
Yeah. RPA at the time, the number of Chris's hasn't changed. It's still four on Mount Rushmore, but Andy's added a third name. Andy Mitchell Gregory pitched this idea to us. He said, power rank the movie Chris's. Evans, Hemsworth, Pratt, and Pine. We had to get a little bit creative since, of course, Film Spotting is a show that was founded on top five lists. You'll hear what we did considering those circumstances, and we're going to replay this. And then, having the benefit of hindsight, 4 years later, we're going to see if we want to make amends for any of our choices and actually alter, re-rank our movie Chris power ranking.
And can I just say that this really was Andy's crowning achievement as PA. That's not to say anything you're about to hear is all that great. But the idea,
but we had fun.
The idea was inspired, and we had a lot of fun.
Here it is from June 2018, our movie Chris power ranking.
Am I not sensitive, clever, well-mannered, considerate, passionate, charming, as kind as I'm handsome, and heir to a throne?
You are everything maidens could wish for.
Then why now?
Do I know?
The girl must be mad. You know nothing of madness.
Chris Pine with Billy Magnuson in the 2014 film adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Into the Woods. Pine showing off some singing chops and making a case for himself as the top five Chris in all the land. Sensitive, clever, well-mannered. We'll see if he will rule the day in our top five movie Chris's. It is our definitive Chris power ranking. This started when? This being a thing where everyone talked about the four Chris's.
Oh, man, it's been a while now. It has been a while. I'm trying to remember when Pine was on Saturday Night Live actively making fun of it. Was that
for
A Wrinkle in Time, or was it for something earlier?
I
don't even
know.
But yeah, I mean, basically, it's been around long enough. It's time to settle it.
It is.
So let's do it.
Let's do it. Even if I'm not totally ready, I'm still weighing where to put.
I love that our silliest top five that you weren't initially on board, you've now taken so seriously.
There has to be stakes.
It's driven you so crazy to get right that you're still not finished as we're talking.
I'm not. I'm gonna make it up as I go, Josh.
Okay,
now,
I
did
wait.
Love this tweet, and we're going to feature, I'm sure, a lot of listener comments here as we get to our rankings from Sarah Welch, a listener I'm pretty sure here in Chicago.
Yep.
She said, my personal rule of Chris's, the one I saw in a movie last is the best. The Infinity War Amendment, any movie featuring three Chris's makes me miss the missing Chris, so he wins out.
Very
so
good.
I guess Pine right now is Sarah Welch's favorite
because
he is the one of these four Chris's who is not in Infinity War.
I don't think all four of them could be in a single movie. Something
the universe
might
would implode.
I believe so.
The tale of the tape here. All four of the Chris's were born between 1979 and 1983. We'll start with 79. Who do you think is the oldest of the four Chris's?
If I had to guess, I'd say Evans is the oldest Chris.
Evans is not. Chris Pratt is the oldest. He just turned 39.
All right.
Okay. Who do you think's the youngest?
Youngest Chris, I believe, is Hemsworth.
You are correct. He will be 35 this August.
Okay.
As the youngest, he has the fewest credits on IMDb. This includes movies and television, and I'm sure a few other miscellaneous things thrown in there. Hemsworth, 38 on IMDb, compared to 48 for Pine and 49 for both Evans and Pratt. So right in line with each other there. I want to hear how you approach this, how you did ultimately decide on your ranking. Did you apply any criteria to it, Josh? And then we'll actually get into what isn't a top four. Oh, no, we're going to make it a top five. This is Film Spotting after all. So there will be a Chris that we haven't mentioned yet who enters the mix.
Hey, Chris, yet to be named. I did apply some very rigorous science to this list, Adam. And first off, we should note the reason you're mentioning the ages is we did require them to be of the same generation.
Yeah, we're not going to consider Christopher Walken
or Chris Cooper
a Chris.
Exactly.
Not in this case.
So I did ask myself, aside from the ages, what defines a movie Chris? And this is kind of what I came up with. He has to have a dreaminess that if the camera catches him at just the wrong angle, or the material just isn't there to support him, could dissolve into blandness. Like, these guys are A-list stars.
I think that's fair.
But they all share something that a slight turn and it could go to boring.
Okay.
I think that's why we get a mixed up.
Different approach, or I phrase it differently. but I think we're actually in line with each other.
Okay.
We'll see how it goes.
I feel like that's kind of what they have in common. That's why it's not just the names, why we do get them mixed up. And for the record, I say that as a fan of all these actors.
Yes,
like,
me too.
I genuinely like them all.
This is a case where the one who's in last place or the lowest ranked, that doesn't mean we dislike them.
Correct. Exactly.
It is a top five after all.
Yes. So aside from that, I did sort of what you just did, looked at the filmographies. Listeners were very helpful and very vocal.
Well, that's
about
the thing.
Their opinions.
Listeners are really swaying me from my ranking.
Yeah,
that's where I'm wrestling the most internally because of the impassioned pleas of our listeners.
So I took that into consideration as well. And then at the end of the day, as you do with these important matters, Adam, you just go with your gut.
You do. And gut instinct is where I started with this. In fact, our families actually got together Friday night and we kind of threw out our gut instinct rankings. I have now gone against those for the most part, Josh. And yeah, I did consider immediately just who I think I like the most when you say their names, who has made the highest number of good movies I thought about, who makes the most interesting choices. But all those things, and there are other factors as well, all those things culminate in, for me, a simple yet very difficult challenge. And it's one I know I have used in the past. I've applied it to some poll questions, maybe even Film Spotting Madness and some of those choices. You walk into a movie theater. There are four screens, only four screens. You have to pick one movie to see. You have no prior knowledge of the films that are playing inside any of the theaters. There are no posters, no additional information at all. All you see above each door is a name. Hemsworth, Evans, Pine, Pratt. Now, these movies don't actually exist or don't exist yet. So you aren't taking a gamble that, well, it might be a Captain America movie if it says Evans and I love those movies, or if it says Hemsworth, it might be Thor, or if it says Pratt, it's a Jurassic World movie, or maybe more likely a Guardians of the Galaxy movie. Of course, it could be a Star Trek movie or a Wonder Woman movie with Pine. It's none of those. This is some wholly original new movie. And you can only base your choice on the lead performer. So what it comes down to then, Josh, for me, when you think about it in those terms, it's which actor do you most enjoy watching perform?
Yeah, I did not use that exact.
That was very clarifying for me.
Well, I'm glad you used that. I did not, but it also makes me feel more confident of my answer if I had gone that route. So
okay, so
I like it.
This is not a traditional countdown. We're not going to go five through one like we normally do since obviously all of our choices overlap. We are going to start with The Outlier. It's a Film Spotting top five. We've heard these four names. Who then is the fifth movie Chris in the Film Spotting cinematic universe, Josh?
Well, I really was hoping that Bradley Cooper's middle name was Christopher. So that I could slide. He just seems like he'd fit, right?
Yeah.
And I
yeah.
know you're not as big of a fan.
No,
of him,
but I'm
as
coming
I
around.
Am. But he could be a movie Chris. But unfortunately, that's not the case. I've now forgotten what Bradley Cooper's middle name is, but it's not Chris. I did look it up. Instead, I went with Chris O'Dowd.
Yeah.
An Irish actor I first saw in Bridesmaids. He was very charming and funny, playing the traditional love interest there. I actually forgot until I was looking into his filmography. He does have Marvel credentials. He
That's
had a
right.
small part
the
in
Dark
Thor,
World.
The Dark World.
The one MCU movie I haven't seen.
Probably not why he's on my list, but speaking of listener input, Jeff Milo sent us this email. I think he captures it well. O'Dowd's range can go from lovable loser in Pirate Radio to can't put your finger on it creepiness in Calvary to ball of sunshine smarmy showman in The Sapphires and be believable in each role. So these are mostly character actor parts that he's had, but in all of them that I've seen, I thought he's been very good. And I do think he has leading Chris potential if he were to get that shot.
Huh. Very different, of course, physically from all the other Chris's that we are going to discuss.
I'd say he's not too far off from Pratt territory.
Yeah, maybe so, but he is more.
Cast the guy
and
as
I
a
say
lead
this,
in a Marvel movie.
I say this
he
with love.
He would bulk up.
I say this with love, Chris O'Dowd. There's something more naturally physically goofy about him, but then that's what I really like about him, and it's something Jeff Milo gets at. I'm going to read another part from his email. He mentions that with Sam Rockwell's recent Oscar for a Martin McDonagh film, we should return to the lesser appreciated Calvary, where O'Dowd is almost playing an early prototype for Rockwell's Dixon. Subtle shades of ignorance, racism, and occasional lack of tact, and something possibly dormantly sinister beneath. Here, with his reading of the line, not everyone can carry the weight of the world.
You're saying he beats it up?
Don't quote me on it, but that's what I'm assuming. Yeah.
She speaks in riddles half of the time. I can't make any sense out of her. I think she's bipolar or lactose intolerant, one of the two. I don't know where I am with her anymore, Father. And if I'm honest with you, I'm kind of glad to have her off my hands.
Even if this new fella's knocking her about?
But she wants that to do with me.
What?
Not everyone can carry the weight of the world.
So that from John Michael McDonagh's Calvary, Martin's brother. I love that movie. It was among my top 10 of the year it came out. And the fact that he is this goofy presence, naturally so goofy. I just can't use a better word for it, Josh. And yet there is that sinister quality to him in that movie. He's just a loose cannon that makes him really compelling in that movie. And I think in a lot of movies.
So is he your fifth Chris?
Well, I think we need to agree that we should anoint him the fifth Chris. And here's why as well. I only had one other candidate. Okay. And it is Chris Messina,
yeah,
who we both like. I didn't see him on the Mindy Project. I know he was on that TV show with Mindy Kaling, but he's someone who I know we've both liked in A Way We Go.
Yeah,
he's
I always think of him in A Way We Go.
Vicky
kind
Cristina,
of crushing there.
Barcelona. He's in Argo. He's in Ruby Sparks, another movie I like. He is, I think of him as an indie guy who brings some natural charm and a really good sense of humor to his parts. I don't feel like he's ever really gotten the right juicy role for him yet. I remember seeing an interview with him, I think on a late night talk show, and he was talking about last year's Affleck movie, Live by Night, and he plays a gangster in that movie, and he gained like 40 pounds for it. And I think I just got the impression that Chris Messina thought maybe this was going to be one of those breakout roles for him, and then nobody saw that film, including, I think, neither of us.
No, I didn't see that, but he is, he's also one of the most reliable faces. You know, when he comes on screen, he was one of those guys, you know, this is going to be good no matter what the rest of the movie is.
I completely agree. I don't think he works for this list, though, because I think he's a little bit older. He is a little bit older, born in 74. He has 58 credits to his name, but just a little bit out of the range of these other Chris's, I think O'Dowd is a perfect compliment to the other.
So Messina, honorable mention Chris.
Yes.
O'Dowd is now...
Oh, I had him. Yeah, I had
him
at five.
And number four. I mean, I'm really going to...
I knew you were going to do this.
Things up in the Chris universe.
I knew it.
I won't tell you who he's surpassing just quite yet.
Well, you are about to, I think, because we are now actually going to get to the big four, if not the top four, according to Josh. And we're going to do this in the order that they came out in a recent Twitter poll I posted at FilmSpotting. 1,500 responses, pretty good number over just a couple of days. The definitive Chris ranking poll, I put him in alphabetical order, and coming in last, according to FilmSpotting listeners, fourth of four, Josh, Chris Pratt, 18%. Where did Chris Pratt come out for you?
Here is where I abandon my family. Very pro Chris Pratt.
Yes, they are.
I am as well. To be clear, once again, we are favorable towards all of these Chris's, but I've got him at number five. O'Dowd passed him up. And I think this is strictly a matter of the material he's been given or has chosen. Clearly, neither of us feels that the Jurassic World movies serve him very well at all. I'm not that wild about the Guardians of the Galaxy films. I'm a little cooler than most people on those. I do admit he has some very funny moments in them. For me, he's maybe one of the better things about them. So I will give him that. I think Infinity War is a really good example of his Marvel problem, though. He gets some of the biggest laugh lines in that movie.
For sure.
But he's also at the heart of some of the story problems that we discussed.
He's saddled with a real burden.
Yes, you in particular were bothered by the way Peter Quill fails in that film. I've never bought the romance between him and Zoe Saldana's Gamora, which is crucial to Infinity War, and it just doesn't have the payoff it needs because of that. So I don't know that Pratt has found the right stuff to really catapult him as far as the other Chris's have gone. Here's the bottom line for me. The guy has not had a chance to do anything as good as Andy Dwyer in Parks and Rec in the movies. I still think that's his best performance by far. And so I can't, I can't rank him higher because of that.
Okay, that's all fair. And first, I did not think so boldly as to consider putting Chris O'Dowd or anyone else ahead of the four people who inspired our list. You went out on a limb there and
we gotta
God bless you, Josh. Okay. But that doesn't mean I'm not bold. Chris Pratt's my number two.
What?
Again, go back to my criteria.
What possible reason?
I'll try to answer you, Josh. Here's my question for you.
Yeah, according to your calculus, if his name is over the theater marquee, there's a very small chance that's a good movie.
No, I don't think so at all. I think it would
look at what he's picked.
Yes, but I'm not basing it on that. I'm basing it on just performance.
Him.
Just him as a performer.
But has he proven himself able to find something that will allow him to perform?
Are you going
to
let me explain?
Okay, go ahead. I'm very upset about this number two ranking of Chris Pratt.
I knew you would be. Does anybody remember laughter? Does anybody go to the movies to be entertained anymore? Now, another name that is going to come up that I might actually be moving from number three to number one could just as easily be in this spot in addition to number one. It's that close between these top three. But that actor, he undoubtedly has more range than Pratt. Probably everyone on this list we're considering has more range. But I think range only goes so far if you're applying my theater test. I can't count on what range is going to offer me for 2 hours. But I can almost guarantee that if I walk in the door marked Pratt, I'm going to laugh out loud somewhere between 1 and 7 times. And that's a lot. That's a lot for me. And I think I know I'm going to marvel at least once at a bit of physical or verbal humor, something that he brings to that moment.
An
humor
expression,
he brings,
a
an
reaction.
Expression, exactly.
That's true.
That he brings as a performer to the material. And I say all of this as someone who knows Andy Dwyer more from memes than actual Parks and Rec episodes. I probably saw 2 or 3 episodes of that series, enjoyed it. I know why everyone loves it, just was never able to devote the time. Now, secondary to this, but I will mention it, I started by just considering their filmographies and I ranked for me their individual top 5 movies. Pratt's got a pretty dominant, to me, top 4. Her, Zero Dark Thirty, Moneyball, and The Lego Movie. Now, the counter to that is he's a supporting player in 3 of those. And in Zero Dark Thirty, he literally could have been replaced by any other actor who looked the part, and it would have been the exact same movie. But I like that vocal performance a lot in The Lego Movie, where he's playing the regular guy and yet is never boring the way you would expect the regular guy to be.
That's the real counter to my ranking of him. I love The Lego Movie.
Yep.
I would probably say, as much as I do like his performance, there are maybe 6 or 7 other things about that movie I love more, but he's good there. There's no arguing that. That's a strong one.
Look, it's not my fault. I have no idea how this thing got on my back.
Of course, buddy. I believe you.
Great.
I believe you, too. You see the quotations I'm making with my claw hands? It means I don't believe you. Why else would you show up with that thing on your back just 3 days before President Business is going to use the crackle to end the world?
President Business is going to end the world? But he's such a good guy. In Octan, they make good stuff. Music, dairy products, coffee, TV shows, surveillance systems, all history books, voting machines. Wait a minute.
Come on, you can't be this stupid.
As Scott Hatteberg in Moneyball, it's not one of the key strengths of that movie, but I was rewatching some of it earlier today, and the scene where Brad Pitt's character and one of his coaches, I think, goes to try to recruit him to play first base is one of the best scenes in the movie. I did find this profile of him recently in Vanity Fair, where the writer said he played Andy Dwyer, the friendly chubby boyfriend on Parks and Rec, before executing a miraculous switch to action hero in 2014's Guardians of the Galaxy. It'd be like George Costanza turning into Harrison Ford, and Pratt is compared to Harrison Ford, though Pratt is funnier. Looking for the proper mix, I'd say Bruce Willis with a dash of Seth Rogen. He can play deadpan wise ass better than just about anyone. I agree. I agree with the assessment, the comparison of Willis mixed with Seth Rogen, and how good he is at being that deadpan wise-ass. I guess I just find it enjoyable. And that Star-Lord role, I'm with you. I'm kind of mixed. I'm pretty in the middle on those Guardians movies. But if you think about Pine and Evans or Hemsworth, despite how talented they are, I don't think if you replace Chris Pratt in those movies with any one of those guys that those movies work better. In fact, I think they probably work worse. I think that Quill character needs not only a goofball a la Pratt and Chris O'Dowd, but they need a self-deprecating quality, that overstuffed sense of self that actually reveals just how kind of weak he really is. Not just an ability to be comedic, which all three of those actors definitely have. I think we need to root for him a little bit because we actually kind of pity him and find him to be pathetic. And then he surprises us. And I guess I like those surprises with Pratt.
Yeah, I think Hemsworth for sure could probably do the Star-Lord role.
He'd be the closest,
and, yeah,
maybe.
He'd be the closest. Pine could probably do it too, but it would be different. It would absolutely be different.
Okay.
All right.
So we start off with a massive disagreement.
Okay, let's go on. Let's just move
on. Let's go on. Third place in the Film Spotting listener poll. Chris Evans, 23%. Where did you rank him?
Well, Adam, we've often said we have smart listeners, and I agree here.
Okay.
I have Chris Evans ranked 3 on my list, and my instinct was that he was going to be a lot higher.
Yeah,
because
me too.
I love his Captain America. Absolutely love him. I think he's essential to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He's sort of the earnest heart of what's going on there. And I think without that, otherwise, it might tilt way too far towards smarminess and snarkiness. I like that it has that element to it with a lot of its characters, but only because you've got Captain America there holding things together.
Earth's mightiest heroes pulled us apart like cotton candy.
Seems like you walked away all right.
Is that a problem?
I don't trust a guy without a dark side. Call me old-fashioned.
Well, let's just say you haven't seen it yet.
Otherwise, though, trying to tear us apart, right? Evans is fine in Snowpiercer. He's pretty funny in a bit part in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. In the first Fantastic Four movies.
No,
which is
we don't have to even mention those.
But you do. I mean, it's on his record. If he has another gear... I haven't seen it. I know he has
done a good way to put it.
A few dramatic roles, so maybe this is on me more than him, but I don't recall a lot of conversation or acclaim for some of the other stuff he's done. So I've got Evans at 3 solely on the strength of his Steve Rogers.
Okay, well, I have him at 4, and I am surprised like you that he's that low for me just based on where I thought he would be. I thought he'd be in my top 2 when I was just going off of my gut instinct. He does have a lot of very good movies. You mentioned Scott Pilgrim. I don't love quite as much as a lot of people do, but he's pretty funny in that in a very bit part. I do like the Bong Joon-ho film Snowpiercer quite a bit. I'm glad he made that choice as well. I'm glad he made the choice to be in the Danny Boyle film Sunshine, even if I don't particularly remember his performance or character. But of course, Captain America, those are, for me and for you, the best Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. And whatever new battle gear he's wearing in Infinity War with the whole just got back from Burning Man beard and hair, well, that's the Chris I most...
It's a little more trimmed than Burning Man, Adam.
A little, but that's the Chris I most want to be, apparently. I didn't know that until I saw Infinity War. He also, just his overall persona, he seems like a good dude. A smart dude, as much as we can determine these things based on a public persona. I like where his head's at. He's so incredibly sincere and earnest, yes, a presence on and off screen. Rory Dunn, a listener, said something similar on Twitter and might be right. He brings the most gravity and goodwill to his performances.
Yeah.
Maybe so, but sincerity and goodwill, earnestness, those aren't necessarily fun.
That's not going to make even, you a top Chris.
No, they're not even that interesting. So of the four, he, for me, I realized, was the actor I think I'm least likely to be transported somewhere solely by a Chris Evans performance. Like you said, where's that next gear that is going to transport me there? Right now, I think he's the least likely to pull it off, despite how much I do appreciate him overall as an actor and, as I said, a person. But based on that, he's 4th.
Do you tell everyone about
the
that?
The handle's imprinted, right? Like a security code? Whosoever is carrying Thor's fingerprints is, I think, the literal translation.
Yes, well, that's a very, very interesting theory. I have a simpler one. You're all not worthy.
Next up on our Chris Power ranking, Film Spotting listeners have in 2nd place, Hemsworth, 27%. So all pretty close, 18, 23, 27% Hemsworth.
This is where things get dicey.
Okay.
Things get really tough up here at the top. I also have Chris Hemsworth as the number 2 Chris.
Okay.
And as you know, this is Debbie's by far favorite Chris. So naturally, I have to put him at number 2. It's a reasonable way to deal with my insecurity about that. So number 2 he is. He could have been my number 1 though, Adam. I was on board with the sense of self-awareness that he brought to the part of Thor with the first movie. I like the first Thor more than most people because I think that germ of self-awareness was definitely there. They allowed him to really live into it with further Thor performances. I think you see hints of it in something like Cabin in the Woods. And Ghostbusters, I still contend he gave the funniest performance in that recent Ghostbusters.
For sure.
He's great.
Sadly, but he did.
Now, Range, well, he's shown that he's willing to try, considering he teamed up with Michael Mann, of all people, for the 2015 hacking thriller Black Hat. He was probably, I think, mostly a model there for Mann's cinematic stylings, but he did bring a nice intimacy to the performance as well. So I like that he made that choice and went in that direction. Remember also, he was in Star Trek. He was the father of Pines, George. James T. Kirk. So nice connection there. I guess that's another reason he should probably be at number one, but I'm going to go the way listeners went and rank him at number two.
Okay. Well, we agree that we both probably should have had Hemsworth at number one. And in fact, up until about an hour ago, I had him there. But
what about Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom changed
your
mind,
changed my mind about Chris
Hemsworth?
You're
in the middle of Fallen Kingdom I don't think Hemsworth is going to be number one.
I'm bumping him down to number three, and I think it's because I just can't make as strong of a case as I hoped I'd be able to make. Based on when I applied the theater test, Hemsworth did stand out for me. I have to give that some credence, and I think I'll try to articulate it. There is something purely pleasurable about watching him as an actor perform. He's a compelling superhero. He's a compelling dramatic actor. Black Hat applies there. I think even Cabin in the Woods, whatever you want to call that movie, there's elements of drama, of comedy, of horror. And he is the best thing about Ghostbusters, partly due to how poorly conceived that movie was. The most enjoyable scenes were the ones where his dim-witted but oh-so-wanting-to-help assistant played off of Kristen Wiig and company. He gave us there, though, a glimpse of the comedic abilities that he had and that he would show later with Thor Ragnarok, a movie that I respect and admire maybe more than actually love. I really like Taika Waititi's approach, the absurdity of that approach, but I think it really only works because of how deftly Hemsworth handles the tone. And without him and without that ability, I think that movie would even fall down the MCU rankings more for me than it is. And I hate to dwell too much on those MCU movies, but I feel like now through those three films, even though I haven't seen the second Thor movie, through the Avengers movies, he's now the superhero who's been put through the most as an MCU character. I think really put through the ringer. I know we can look at Tony Stark and probably a few others, but he's this Norse god who the first movie made a lot out of being a fish out of water. And now they've turned him into really, I think, the most interesting of all of those heroes. The character who is actually suffering the most, who has the most kind of range of emotions that he is going through at any one time. And I think that's a depth that Hemsworth brings to that character. And I think we touched on this last week when we were teasing this top five, that I love those scenes in Infinity War where Pratt and Hemsworth play off each other. It's so smart how they use them because those characters are obviously such natural opposites. Their Chris personas are antithetical to each other, where Hemsworth is this formidable presence who surprises us by being silly sometimes, but he's someone who doesn't take himself too seriously, or at least as that Thor character has evolved. And then Pratt is this silly presence who occasionally surprises us by being formidable, but all he does is take himself too seriously. So you put those two together, someone who's always in command and in control of the situation and someone who never is, but thinks he is or desperately wants to be, they're perfect foils for each other. And the way that Thor character has evolved, someone who I thought would be, frankly, a pretty boring superhero, and the way that he's become now the superhero who I'd probably be most inclined to go watch another movie that was just about them, an individual Thor movie, regardless of who the director is, I think that would be the case, and I give Hemsworth the brunt of the credit for that.
I really wish I had my hammer.
Hammer?
Quite unique. It was made from this special metal from the heart of a dying star. And when I spun it really, really fast, it gave me the ability to fly.
You rode a hammer?
No, I didn't ride the hammer.
The hammer rode you on your back?
No. I used to spin it really fast, and it would pull me off the...
Oh, my God. The hammer pulled you off?
The ground. It would pull me off the ground, up into the air, and I would fly. Every time I threw it, it would always come back to me.
Well, and for me, by now, you know in these Avengers movies who you're going to perk up for when they come on the screen. You know, when they show up, when it's their turn to get 3-4 minutes, however they dice these things up, you're like, oh, this will be good. This I want to see. And yeah, I think Hemsworth is at the top of that list right now for me when it comes to those films.
Okay. So if people are playing along at home and they're crossing the Chris's off their list,
I'm sure people have, you know.
Oh, yeah, the board.
The blackboard drawn up board. And they're tracking everything.
And we'll recap this later because I know it's oh so important how we have ranked them. Film Spotting listeners on Twitter did decide that the top movie Chris, with 32% of the vote, is Chris Pine. And it would seem that we agree, Josh.
They made the right choice.
Okay.
Consensus. We're
going to
have Chris Consensus.
Oh,
the universe,
all is right.
The universe is pleased tonight.
Yeah, maybe there's not balance. Maybe we need Thanos to bring some balance and give us another Chris, but we're going with Pine.
It's all about the range. It really, for me, I know you sort of discounted that with your calculus there about the theaters, but it really is, for me, all about the range. Adam Wells shared this on my Facebook page. Pine has turned into a fascinating actor who I can't wait to see, whether it's as the lead in summer popcorn flicks like Star Trek, the love interest in Wonder Woman, or an occasionally heavy dramatic turn like Hell or High Water. He is making much better choices with what he works on, and he is pulling off the different tones of his projects with aplomb. I do think Hell or High Water is crucial for his filmography here, and it's a film I still need to revisit. I liked it quite a bit, liked him in it, but I think I might have underrated it. And when I think of him, I now think of that part. I think of certain scenes in that film in the context of all this other bigger stuff that he's done as well. I don't think he'd be at number one for me if it wasn't for Hell or High Water and his filmography.
I've been poor my whole life. Told my parents, their parents before them. It's like a disease. Passing from generation to generation, becomes a sickness. That's what it is. It affects every person you know. But not my boys. Not anymore. This is theirs now.
Now, lots of other listeners pointed out his musical turn that we heard, Into the Woods. I actually wasn't quite as high on him in that, but I do like the chance he took and that he can do that, that he has that in his toolkit.
Yes.
That is very impressive, whatever you feel about the performance or the film. Here's the last thing, though, that really did put him over the top for me. He has everything, I think, that all the other Chris's have, to varying degrees, but he has all that stuff. And then he has this. A huge generosity as an actor when you watch him on screen. I'm thinking of recent supporting parts like the dad in Wrinkle in Time, where he's fantastic, or the love interest, as Adam Wells mentioned, in Wonder Woman. He does really great work in both of those films, but he also knows how and when to concede a scene to the actor or the character that he's sharing it with, to give it over to them for the sake of what the story needs, what the film itself needs, what his fellow performer needs.
Mm-hmm.
That's always something he's willing to do. So basically, I think I get the sense that Pine might be the one trying the least to be ranked number one Chris.
Hmm.
And for that, I think I have to put him up there.
Well said. I think for me, it really was, as I suggested, the listeners who kind of wore me down here because I really couldn't argue with some of their takes. Alex Charner on Twitter said, performance by performance, Pine's versatility, skill, and willingness to take artistic risks makes him my choice. Sean Lesher said, only one of these Chris's has sung Sondheim on film, so he shall be the Chris that is best. And I honestly expected to counter that because Sam also, we really have consensus. Sam has Pine at number one. And when I suggested that I might put Pratt even ahead of him, it was Sam who said, well, but Sondheim, like the fact that Pine can even do that, he was giving him points for that.
Right.
I really thought that if I Googled it, I'd find that Chris Pratt also has that ability, that he probably just hasn't shown it
it's
yet.
It's possible.
But I did enough YouTubing to find that Chris Pratt is one of those singers who can hold a tune. He could not pull off appearing in
not
any
Sondheim,
musical.
Huh?
No, and certainly not Sondheim. He couldn't. I don't know about Hemsworth and Evans, but that's not the sole reason why we're putting Pine here at number one. Dustin Mills in Metamora, Illinois, said, underrated performance for Pine is The Finest Hours. His performance makes this sappy melodrama a surprisingly enjoyable film. He plays every role with a confident sincerity, there's that word like Evans, that makes him and his co-stars better. Generosity. Josh, he might be the best actor right now. He doesn't mean just among the Chris's, the best. He says, well, maybe second to Oscar Isaac. I think when that word versatility comes up, it makes sense. And it makes sense for him to be at number one because he's in some ways an amalgam of all the other Chris's. He has generally the comic timing of Pratt. He has the leading man good looks and, yes, the sincerity of Chris Evans. And he has the charisma and charm of Hemsworth. I didn't like Into the Woods. I didn't like that movie. And I do recall, I rewatched it today and it made a lot more sense to me now. On first viewing, I recall thinking that Pine actually went too far with that character, specifically in the musical number scene that we heard and that agony scene. And I get it. It's a riff on the Cinderella Prince. He's winking.
Right. Yes,
he's
totally
winking the same way that the whole movie, in a way, is winking at us. But he's winking so much. It's so hammy. It's almost like Pine instead is doing William Shatner doing a Stephen Sondheim
That's
musical.
My memory of it, too. Yeah.
So I was a little bit down on it, but rewatching it today, I enjoyed it more. Let me tell you why I didn't think initially he was going to be my number one. And I will restate that, like you, I like all four of these Chris's in question quite a bit. He maybe has given the best performance of the bunch in Hell or High Water, and I do love his Captain James T. Kirk. I love that he's got the acting chops that maybe some of the other Chris's don't have, but I think he might be the least likely, or I would be less likely to find him to be the best thing about whatever movie he's in. The same way we talked about what Pratt brings to the humor in Guardians of the Galaxy, a better example would be Hemsworth and Ghostbusters, or what he is doing in some of those Avengers movies recently and in Thor Ragnarok. I don't know that I would watch Hell or High Water, and I love that performance. It was in my top five lead actors of the year. I still don't know that he's ever going to be the thing, the element of a film that as an actor, I say, he's better than the material.
Well,
he stands out.
So what? Maybe that's the flip side of the generosity thing, and
maybe
that's not so bad.
It's not. You're right. And it maybe shows that he is making some good choices. One of those choices that a few listeners mentioned, Z for Zachariah, I haven't seen. Kevin McLenathan was a listener who sent us a very good note on that and said this about Pine. All four of them are more or less equally adept at running through the paces required for leading man roles. Stoicism, charm, humor, heroism. I think that's fair, but Pine has proven himself capable of playing other notes that the other three have either not attempted or not succeeded at, that according to Kevin, and thus we end our Chris Power ranking.
And Chris we Pine. Crown Pine the Uber Chris.
We do. We can't wait to hear your thoughts. You know what my favorite thing about this top five is? There's really no honorable mentions. We got Messina in, and we don't have to wax on about all the things that we wanted to throw in to make sure we didn't sound stupid.
I think we probably covered it. If there's another Chris out there, we should have included. I feel like we would have heard by now.
Yeah. Tell us what we got wrong, though, with our rankings. Who is the true master of all the Chris's? Feedback at filmspotting.net.
We're all white guys, but these aren't the white guys I am. I'm 6 feet tall and Chris Evans
is 6 feet as well.
Chris, oh my God.
There it was from June 2018, just a little over 4 years ago, our movie Chris Power Ranking. And yeah, I got a little bit of Josh in me. I went a little contrarian at the time. I put Chris Pratt at number two, though revisiting my reasoning, I stand by my argument, even as I could have shuffled those list of four guys completely and been happy with laying it out that way too. So now it is 4 years later, little over 4 years, Josh. And if we look at the films they've made and considered whatever has transpired since, are any of those titles urging you one way or another as far as rethinking your ranking?
Probably the place to start is to ask if we both feel comfortable with Pine at number one still. I think I do. And he hasn't done a ton since that would maybe launch him to the top of that list. But
no,
I really like him in A Wrinkle in Time. Small part, supporting part is the dad. He has, I think, one or two key scenes, hugely emotional scenes that he pulls off. You know, Wonder Woman 1984, I like how he's handled his role in that franchise. The movie itself was not that great, but he hasn't done himself any harm, really, at least of the stuff that I've seen. So I feel okay having him at the top. How about you?
Yeah, I'm not saying that that's where I ended up on my re-rank, but I could make the case that he definitely still belongs at number one. Don't feel bad at all about that choice. I'm with you.
Okay. All right. So then let's look at Hemsworth.
Mm-hmm.
He's done, obviously, more MCU. Avengers Endgame. We just discussed Thor, Love and Thunder. He was also in Bad Times at the El Royale, Men in Black International. Ouch, that one hurts.
Yeah.
Extraction, Spiderhead. Have not seen those two. Coming up, 2024, he's going to be in George Miller's Furiosa.
Yeah, with excited Anya about that.
Taylor-Joy. So that's promising. Yeah, Hemsworth, three for you, two for me. Here's, I might, this is where I might shift things. I might reshift things here. Even though I just praised Hemsworth in Love and Thunder, I might move Evans ahead of him. Should I run through what Evans has been up to?
Yeah, let's talk about Evans. And I'll just say that I agree with your assessment as you ran through those titles. I did like Bad Times at the El Royale and Hemsworth in it, so that helps his case a little bit. Let's go to Evans, though.
Okay, Avengers Endgame, Knives Out, that's the big one, right? The Red Sea Diving Resort, did not see that. Apple TV Plus limited series, Defending Jacob. Unfortunately, this is the first I've heard of that.
I remember it, didn't watch it.
Okay, and then Lightyear, which I did see, and, you know, I don't know what he was supposed to do. He's not playing the Tim Allen Buzz Lightyear, but he was kind of bland in that vocal performance. For me, though, it is Knives Out that he's so strong in. Tricky part, incredibly fun part, gets to play different sides of his persona than what we see in the MCU. I would consider flipping Evans and Hemsworth based on what they've done since. It's close, though. It's not a clear thing for me. Now, you had Hemsworth 3, Evans 4.
I did.
Where are you going to move him now?
Well,
I know you're kicking Pratt out of the list. So
just wait. Okay. Well, I'm going to kick him off the Mount Rushmore completely. He's not even a movie Chris anymore.
Well,
I don't know if we're going to go that far, but let's just say Evans is going to rise up the charts as we look at my list. And I think what listeners are probably hearing so far, at least of the movies we've seen, and the fact that we haven't seen some of these movies maybe shouldn't be held against them, but at the same time, I don't think a lot of people saw some of these titles. They didn't get a whole lot of acclaim. There wasn't much notice for these performances, and we weren't obviously intrigued enough to go see them. But neither Hemsworth or Pine, as you said, really helped themselves or hurt themselves.
Okay.
And I think with Evans, he helped himself in one major way, which is of all the films that have been made by these actors since 2018, the best by far is Knives Out.
Agreed.
And that performance is the best, Evans as Ransom Drysdale. So I think Evans' stock undeniably goes up. And when you also look back at the titles, I don't know how I slotted him in 4 when you considered that, you know, he of course is good in the Avengers movies. The Captain America movies specifically are among my favorite in the MCU. And then he's in Snowpiercer. And of course, he's in Scott Pilgrim and he's in Danny Boyle's Sunshine. So he's got a really good list of films. And I agree that he definitely needs to come up the list from 4. So that does leave us with Chris Pratt. Mm. And here's the sneaky thing about Pratt. I can see it and hear it in you already. You're just so ready to dismiss him. And that's fine. But you look at his list of titles, Josh, and you have to at least reckon with the fact that The Lego Movie 2 is a good film. He, of course, is in Endgame, like two of the other actors we've mentioned. He's fine, totally fine, in Onward. That's a decent Pixar film. It doesn't help him that we did talk about that Jurassic World movie and had such a good time with it, we decided not to review Dominion from this year. And as I joked earlier, he's barely in Thor Love and Thunder, and the time he does spend on screen, let's just say it's not well spent. Coming soon, Super Mario Brothers? Really? Okay, so Pratt, there's definitely titles in there we can use against him, but there's some decent stuff, like I said, between Endgame, Lego Movie 2, and Onward that you can use in a case for him.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think I just had recency bias too against him from just seeing Jurassic World and that being the impetus for doing these lists, because number 5 does seem a little harsh for me. But I got to say, Well, let's look at O'Dowd, Chris O'Dowd.
we're going that far. We're going to go ahead and include him in the list again of movie Chris's.
Yeah. Yeah. I think,
why not?
I think we can include him. He's still in the club, but here's what makes it difficult. I don't think I've seen any of O'Dowd's stuff since.
Well, it's good that you haven't seen How to Build a Girl, because I don't know if I logged that on Letterboxd or not.
That's one of your one and a halves.
Yeah, that's a one and a half for me. And I do, though, really like him in Juliet Naked from 2018, an Ethan Hawke movie. So that would help O'Dowd's case. Sam helped us by sketching out some other Chris's that we could consider. And the thing is, if we're going to shoehorn another Chris into the conversation, Chris Cooper might actually be my favorite Chris of the bunch. I mean, who's got a better list of titles and performances than Chris Cooper? And since 2018, he's really good in Little Women, the Greta Gerwig film that I adore. So he's also very good in Mary Heller's A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. So I think Cooper, he has a case for this list, Josh.
I mean, he does, but it's not really fair. He might defeat them all just because of his villain in The Muppets alone. So I don't think we should.
Sure.
I don't think we should include him.
Okay. So you're excluding him. You want to actually put Dowd above Chris Pratt, and I suppose that's fine. But let's go ahead and talk about the elephant in the room with Pratt, at least to this extent. Our friend over at the Next Picture Show, Scott Tobias, loves to use this term when talking about elements that may factor into your response or opinion about a film or an actor or anything that don't actually have to do with the film itself or the performer, him or herself. Those are extra textual elements.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not really going to totally get into it because I don't pay enough attention to that type of celebrity talk, I guess, or the fodder that really does fuel a lot of social media to condemn Chris Pratt here. But if you want to Google why do people hate Chris Pratt, as I did earlier today, you'll find articles that give you the whole list from his religious beliefs. He's too religious. He's too conservative. He got a divorce from Anna Faris, and we all love Anna Faris, and he said some things on Twitter that were stupid. Those elements really do seem to have put Chris Pratt in a really negative light with a lot of filmgoers. And I said I don't pay attention to it much, and I don't. And yet it's even affected me, where I find myself now 4 years later recoiling a little bit at the mention of Chris Pratt. Now, that could also have to do with the fact that I disliked that last Jurassic World movie as much as I did and had no desire to see what he was up to in Dominion. So if you consider those elements, it is very easy to bump Pratt way down.
And I feel like I can separate that stuff. I mean, it's a little bit the separating the art from the artist question, although from what I understand, it's not been anything as egregious where we need to have, you know, like the Michael Jackson or Woody Allen conversation, but still, it's a perception, right? And it's a vibe thing. It didn't come into play for me, obviously, ranking him fifth a couple of years ago, but it is hard to completely set aside. I would come to his defense. I'll just say this. Even as Andy on Parks and Rec, that still carries a ton of goodwill for me. I think his sweet spot now, if he's going to be a movie star like this, his sweet spot is something like Guardians of the Galaxy. I don't think they were necessary in Love and Thunder, but I think he plays his scenes well. There's enough of the doofus and the hero that's kind of the sweet spot. That's what was missing in the Jurassic World movie that we saw. Right now, yeah, seems like Pratt, he's going through the fame vortex. It's not, if you look, just look at his filmography. He's working way too much. Seems not to be saying no to anything. Maybe not giving a lot of thought about what he's saying yes to. Maybe he's pursuing parts that don't meet his particular skill set, and fame appears to be, as it does to so many people, possibly eating him alive. So let's hope he comes out the other side. There's still hope, but that sympathy I have for him is not going to make me bump him up in my ranking. He's still my number five, Chris.
Yeah, I am going to still consider these four movie Chris's, as much as I might like Chris O'Dowd or Chris Cooper or Chris Messina, who I mentioned in the top five. And of those four, here's where I'm netting out now in 2022. Are you ready, Josh?
Hit me.
Dance around here a little bit. Hemsworth, he's staying in third place for me. And he's just not helped by my reaction to Love and Thunder, and really the thought of more Thor movies at this point is a big oof for me. Chris Pine, he's bumping down just one slot.
Oh.
I think because of his versatility, he still has to be ahead of Hemsworth, and I've got him at number two. Chris Pratt, jumping back from two to four. And yeah, Chris Evans. He's gone all the way from four to one.
Wow. What a climb. He's going to be so happy when he hears this.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So for me, I'm going to keep Pine at number one. Here's where I am going to do the flip. Don't tell Debbie. I'm bumping Hemsworth down.
Okay.
Evans is moving up for me as well. Not to number one, but he's going to go two. So I've got Pine, Evans, Hemsworth. You know, as I said, haven't seen anything from O'Dowd that he's done. So he hasn't done anything to offend me. I can't punish him.
He's going
to
stay
for my lack of seeing his work. And so I'll keep him at four and I'll keep Pratt at five.
There you go. Those are our movie Chris power rankings. If you have another Chris you'd like to share with us or any feedback on those picks, please do email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. And for more top fives, check out the Film Spotting Archive at filmspotting.net/lists. Josh, that's our show.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook or Twitter or Letterboxd, you can find us at Film Spotting and at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. You can also vote in the current Film Spotting poll, which has us looking ahead a couple of weeks to the release of Jordan Peele's Nope. We want to know, who is your favorite director that made their debut since 2017? To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop, and you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out on digital this weekend, are you like Josh, frantically trying to finish Jane Austen's Persuasion so you can watch the new adaptation starring Dakota Johnson on Netflix? Also, in limited release, one of the best films of the year, the documentary Fire of Love and Neptune Frost, recommended by Josh, a movie that is up for the Golden Brick this year, at least on the short list of our Film Spotting Golden Brick nominees, that is at Facets in wide release. Another Josh recommendation on the show, The Deer King. You can also see Mrs. Harris Goes to Paris, starring Leslie Manville. Paws of Fury, The Legend of Hank is out. This is an animated cats versus dogs Western with the voices of Michael Cera, Ricky Gervais, and how about Mel Brooks? Plus, you can see Where the Crawdads Sing. This is based on the best-selling 2018 novel. Daisy Edgar Jones is a young woman living alone in the marshes of North Carolina who becomes the suspect in a murder case. Next week on Film Spotting, we're not going to talk about any of those movies because we are taking a full week off. But when we come back, it's a big show. Two reviews. We'll not only get to the third film we had teased that we were going to talk about this week, we're going to get to the third film in our Barbara Stanwyck marathon, The Lady Eve, and we are going to talk finally about Jordan Peele's Nope.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.